A miracle of God. As you know, last summer, not this summer, the summer before, we couldn't have camp because of COVID, and I cried, and then I got mad, and then I pretended that the governor didn't know what he was doing, and then I cried some more, and I guess I was just kind of grieving through that, and God enabled us to do what we called a day of camp. We traveled throughout New England and also Pennsylvania, had 13 rallies, and got to serve over 1,300 teenagers, many trusted Christ. And there was about 14 of us in four vehicles, and we carried buckets with us and ropes 6 feet long, so we made sure that we had the exact social distancing in between everybody. But we taught the kids that even though we practice social distancing, God doesn't. We can be as close to God as we want to be. And then we get into this summer, and two things. Number one, the kids wanted to get out of the home, and number two, the parents wanted their kids to get out of their home. And we had 1,450 campers. We have never seen that many. Zero, get this, zero camper COVID cases. Amen. Now, that is only of God, okay? Now, we did make every kid bubble wrap before they come, but other than that, it was great. It really was. I want to share something with you that I do share with the kids sometimes, okay? As we see on the beginning of the slide, as we go into the message, you know, kids struggle. We all struggle. And what we struggle with is just expressing true joy. Why is it so many kids don't want to sing, don't want to smile, are glued to their devices? I think they're a little bit scared of being adults. Why would they want to be an adult? If they examine the adult world, it's kind of scary. Because the adult world complains a lot, and there's tension and financial problems, constant fear of health issues, money problems. Why would any kid want to think, I want to grow up to become like that? It's tough for kids to even set a goal in their life, and therefore, the joy, it disappears. Joy is a fruit of the Spirit. These four words underneath are actually Hebrew words translated rejoice or joy. Simcha, Masses, Rinna, Gil. Say it with me. Simcha, Masses, Rinna, Gil. The word simcha actually means a brightness shining in the face. It's part of your countenance. It is the picture of that young bride as she steps through the door to be married. There's a brightness in the countenance that can be expressed in no other way. Massos means to jump and to leap. It's like the guy at the Gate Beautiful when Jesus healed him. He didn't get up like most of you guys when you're getting old. Oh, man. None of that. He jumped up and started running, okay? Immediately healed. The word rinna means to show. That's what it means. Sorry back there, okay? And you know what the word gil literally means? This is what it means. It means move around in a circle. Did you ever do something just slightly zany just to prove that you enjoy life? Now, my wife and I, when our kids were growing up, we used to keep a Tupperware, a little case in the back seat of the car. Inside were four pair of glasses. Now, these glasses were very unique because we'd be riding down the car, riding down the road. Am I in the right place? Am I going to echo? Okay. Do you want me to go back up here? Okay. And what we would do is we'd take these glasses and put them on. Now, they're cool glasses because he had a big nose and a mustache and furry eyebrows. And people would pass you on the interstate with all four of us, and they'd back up to look again, you know. Or you want to have fun, go through a Dunkin' Donuts drive-thru with those glasses on. It is great. It really is. Just doing something slightly behavior. So crazy just to prove you enjoy life. So when you take Simcha Masses for Nagil and you put it all together, it is an uninhibited expression of delight in what God has done. Can I say that again? It is an uninhibited expression of delight in what God has done for me. And joy is actually more contagious than any COVID that you've ever heard about. So mom and dad, grandparents, if we don't have the joy, what's going to happen to the kids? Yeah. And I want to watch teens smile and enjoy life because it's the coolest time of their entire life. They don't have to worry about some relationships and money and war. No, no, no. It's just being a teenager, okay? So I want them to be able to have this joy. But as we see here, there's some struggles that we face in life, isn't there? Next slide, please. We can get this here, okay? I really struggle in my walk with God. This is what I hear, not just kids, but even big kids like you guys. You struggle with this? Or how about this one? I really struggle with respecting and obeying my parents the way I really should. If you're a teen here today, or maybe even a kid, this is real. Or maybe this, I struggle with temptation. Actually, I almost feel like I fail more than I'm victorious. Or maybe even like this, I really struggle with consistency in prayer, Bible study, memorization, meditation. All the spiritual disciplines I know I should do. Now, as you see in the next slide, there's one word I want to emphasize, and that is the word struggle. And sometimes we think that struggle, oh man, I'm a loser, I'm always struggling. Did you know struggle is a good word? It's a good word. Because if you are struggling, that means you haven't quit. If you're struggling, you haven't given up. Though a righteous man falls seven times, he'll rise up again. Now, I'm not trying to trick you, but do we got this guy named the Apostle Paul? You remember him? Did he win the fight? Yes or no? Did he win the race? Yes or no? The Bible never tells us. Sorry. It never says that he won. In fact, you study closely 2 Timothy. When he came across his finish line, there wasn't even anybody there to cheer him on and clap for him. Paul says, I ran the race, and I kept tripping and falling, Romans 7, but I got back up, and I trip and fall again, and then I got back up. I fought the fight, but oh, I got knocked down so many times. But I didn't quit fighting. When I was in high school, I wrestled. I remember one of our meets, I think I was wrestling 125 that year, and the coach came to me and says, Ram, we got a little problem. I said, what's that? I said, we really, really need to win this meet. But you are going to have to wrestle the state champ. Think I have a chance? Nope. He's going to kill you. So what do you want me to do? You cannot let him pin you. You can't beat him. It's impossible. And if you know anything about wrestling, you get points for takedown, reversal, and all that. He says, all you have to do is keep from getting pinned, and we will win the meet. Oh, so I'm going out there, not even thinking about winning, just thinking about not dying, okay? And I remember he threw me down, and then I tripped him somehow. We went back and forth. I even got a couple points on the guy, and I kept squirming, and he did not pin me, and we won the meet. I refused to let that dude pin me to the mat. I just kept struggling. So how do you do that in a Christian life? Where do you get this strength? Look at this slide here. The grace of God that brings salvation hath appeared to all men. Do you remember that day when the grace of God brought the knowledge to you that your sins needed to be forgiven? And that you couldn't do anything to gain God's favor, but just ask him to forgive you. And by his love and grace, he does. He forgives you and saves you. Do you remember that day? I want you to understand, folks, that this grace of God doesn't stop at salvation. It continues all the way through our sanctification or our Christian growth. Because look what it does after it brings salvation, then teaching us that denying ungodliness and worldly lust, we can live seriously, soberly, righteously, doing right, and godly right now, today, in our present world. You, Dad, can be a godly dad. Mom, you can be a godly mom and a godly wife. Grandparents, you can be godly grandparents. And teens, you can be a godly teen. You can in this present world. But with that in mind, we look for that blessed hope. Maybe this afternoon, maybe I'm only one day off. And the glorious appearing of the great God and of our Savior, Jesus Christ. So what do we know about this grace? Look at this verse. This is probably one of the best definitions I've ever found for the grace of God. Philippians 2, verse 13. It is God who works in you both to will and to do of his good pleasure. What does this mean? It is God who begins to work inside of you, Christian, to do everything that pleases him. But there's two things here, to do and to will. The to do is the divine enablement. It is an unmerited favor. It is a gift to us that we don't deserve. But God says, I will give you the enablement. I will give you the power to please me. But that's not where I'm going to stop. I'm going to make you want to. I am going to put the desire in your heart, the will. I was preaching in, I think it was Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And a guy had gotten saved in prison. He had been out for like 1 week and he came to this men's purity conference. Guy walks up to me, tough guy. Hey, need to talk to you. So what's up? This grace. God will make me want to do right and God will help me to do right. I said, he sure will. I don't understand that. I said, how long have you been a Christian? He says, for a couple months. I said, a year ago, did you want to be pure? No. Do you want to be pure today? Yeah. That's the grace of God already working in your heart. Now, here is a guy, and he's a spiritual giant because he's been saved for a couple months now, okay? You know what his next few words were? Oh, wow. How can I grow in that grace? I'm not being mean, but some of you guys have been married, or excuse me, been saved for like 30 years. And your growth and your grace has not really been too good. He said unto me, my grace is sufficient for thee. You see, my strength is made perfect in weakness. And Paul says, most gladly, therefore, I'll glory, I'll boast, I'll brag in my weaknesses and infirmities. Why? That the power of Christ may rest upon me. I'm not going to make excuse anymore. I am weak. I'm a bum. I'm a mess. But I can be a godly dad and a godly mom because of the power of God and his grace putting the power and the desire in my heart. Look at the next verse. God is able to make all grace abound toward you, that you always, having all sufficiency in all things, may abound to every good work. I love this verse. I'm going to read it again, but I'm going to stop. And every time I stop, you, good and loud, say the next word. Ready? And God is able to make grace abound towards you that you, having sufficiency in things, may abound to good work. Uh-oh. All, always, all, every. Say it with me. All, always, all. There is not one excuse, men, for you to continue with your lust. None. There's no reason, Mom, that you worry all the time. I'm sorry. And those of you that still have anger in your hearts and in your homes, I'm sorry, there is no excuse. Because God says, I will empower you. I will make you want to be pure and make you want to trust, and I will make you want to be patient. I will do that for you. You go, but Rand, why isn't it working? Well, our prayer is, and I know this is your pastor's prayer for all of you, the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ be with you all. Don't you want that for your people? Then as we see in the next slide, we ask a big time question. What would hinder me from being a recipient of God's enabling grace? I'm not talking about salvation. I'm talking about today, yesterday, and tomorrow. What is it that would keep me from having God's grace to give me the want to and the power to be godly today? You ready? Here we go. This verse will tell us. He gives more grace. Wherefore God saith, God resisteth who? And he gives grace to who? Whoa. God says, I will resist the proud. And that word resist is a scary word. It literally means to set your battle in array against. God fights against pride. He only gives his grace, that divine enablement to the humble. Therefore, what do? We submit to God, be submissive to him, resist the devil, he will flee. That's a promise. Okay, he said, but Rand, I'm so weak. Resist the devil, he will flee. And then draw near to God and he will draw near to you. Whoa. We can be as close to God as we want to be. Every single one of us. And God will put within our hearts the power and the desire to do so. So what about this pride? Look at this verse. These six things does the Lord hate. Yea, seven are an abomination unto him. You know what one of them is? A proud look. Rolling your eyes. You know you're better than somebody else because you don't do the bad things that they do. Shaking your head. God hates that. You say, Rand, I would never do that. Well, look at the next verse. Everyone that is proud in heart is still an abomination to the Lord. And every single time we choose to sin, we are exercising our dominion and our power over God's. Sin has a letter I. And every time we sin, we are like turning ourselves into these little gods that we're going to obey. Pride turned a king into a wild animal and an angel into a devil. And pride is destroying our homes and our lives. And I'm telling you what it is. It's stealing the contagious joy right out of our hearts. So what do we do? Look at this next slide. We have to ask a simple question. Am I proud? Don't catch yourself thinking of somebody else that needs this, or you're already proud. Another word for pride is selfishness. And I read a book by a guy named Stuart Scott, From Pride to Humility. Okay, it's right in the middle of a book called The Exemplary Husband. Men, you want to read it? Oh, it'll beat you up, I promise. And as I started reading through some of these thoughts, I said, no, I'm going to do this myself. And I sat down, I started writing out kind of secret manifestations of pride I saw in my own heart. It was the year that we were going to start the Wilds in New England. I had been in North Carolina Wilds for 30 years. I love what I did. I was with the kids. Why would I want to leave and move to New England and start all over? And then when it became a reality and I was driving through all these hills looking for property, then I got like really scared. I thought, Lord, I can't do this without you. And my first thought was, in Rand, stop being so stupid and swallow your pride. Because God resists the proud. I came up with 51. We're not going to go through all of them today, but just for me, let's look at seven. Number one, selfishness. How do I feel? Philippians reminds us, for all seek their own and not the things which are Jesus Christ. How do I feel? My comfort, my free time, my money, my house, my things. And I don't know if you guys struggle with this, but if you wake up in the morning and everything is about me and what's going to happen and stop making me uncomfortable and the little tension that comes between couples because you didn't like something, true love does not behave itself unseemly. And true love never seeks her own. There's a phrase, when mama's not happy, ain't nobody happy. That mama can be dad, mom, kids, everybody. Why? Because selfishness is pride. And my Bible says God resists the proud. He only gives his grace to the humble. Number two. Having a lack of gratitude, because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful. So inspect your own heart. When was the last time you sent a thank you card or gave a verbal thank you or even text a thank you to somebody? When was the last time, wives, you thanked your husband just for working hard all those years so you have a home? Or men, when was the last time you thanked your wife for just at least having food in a clean house? Okay, when was the last time you thanked Jesus for saving you? I tell the teens every week of my life, you need to learn to thank God for saving you every single day of your life. Because when you wake up, say, Lord, I need you today. I can't live without you. Thank you. Thank you for saving me. I didn't deserve it. I don't deserve it. Lord, I need you. But thank you, thank you, thank you. Because you see, we live in this entitlement society. Yeah. Everything I have, I deserve, and I probably deserve a little bit more. In our world today, we're being taught even more with our government situation. My wife can't travel with me much because we take care of her mother. She's 97. She'll be 98 in a couple weeks. She's old. She's feeble. She doesn't leave the house much. But she sews nonstop. She makes quilt tops for mission agencies. And you know what she does? We have these big balls at camp, you know, but the kids are rough on them, and they rip a lot. So I take the bladder out, turn them inside out, I take them to Grammy T, and she sews all the seams so they last longer. So I took a bunch into her recently, and I was sewing it. She was working on them, and she's having a hard time with them. The next day she came to me, and she watches her checking account very closely. She came to me, she says, look at this. I said, what? $1,400 in my checking account. It's not mine. Get it out of there. I said, Mother, the government, I don't care. Get it out of there. I said, well, no, they do this for a stimulus, and they put, get it out of there. It's not mine. I'm thinking, what do I do? She said, okay, I'm not going to fix those big balls. You take that $1,400 and you buy new big balls. So this summer we had brand new big balls at the Wilds. But when it comes to entitlement, wow. Do you really think you deserve the home you live in, the car you drive, the kid you have? Do you deserve to be able to meet like this in a church like this? Do you even stop to think about thanking God for everything He's given you? Wow. If you don't have a thankful heart, then you're proud. And my Bible says God resists the proud. He only gives grace to the humble. Number three, laziness is a sure sign of pride. The sluggard is wiser in his own conceit than seven men that can render a reason. Proverbs 24 is a very interesting passage. I went by the field of the slothful and by the vineyard of the man void of understanding, and lo, it was all grown over with thorns, and nettles had covered the face thereof, and the stone wall therefore was broken down. Now, if mom today wrote this passage, it would sound like this. I went by the bedroom of my teenager, and behold, the room was all broken down, for this man and girl of no understanding, there were green fuzzy things growing all over the bed, and things in the corner I've never seen before, and things hanging from the doorknobs, and even the bed was broken down. Are you lazy? Did you make your bed this morning? Team? Dad, did you make your bed this morning? That's mom's job. Oh, is she the like slave of your kingdom? Now, I probably shouldn't use this as a proof text. Probably shouldn't, but I'm going to tell you anyway because it's interesting to me. Jesus died. And often in the Bible, death is compared to sleep. He was buried. He rose again, right? And then this guy named Peter and John, they have this race, and they get to the tomb, and when they look inside, were their grave clothes like thrown all over? They were folded up. Either Jesus took time to make his bed or an angel helped him with it, okay? I don't know, but that probably shouldn't be a truth test for your making your bed. There's a lot of areas in life that we can become lazy. So, you ready? Are you lazy in your prayer life? Dad, have you gotten lazy in your thought life? Are you lazy in your devotional life? Oh, we got time to pull our phone out. play games and check on our friends, but we're totally too busy for God. And if in any of these areas you have become lazy, I have to let you know, the conceitedness of a lazy person proves that laziness is a manifestation of pride. And God resists the proud. He only gives grace to the humble. Number four. Being an angry or argumentative person, I'm telling you, it's a sure sign of pride. Proud and haughty scorner is his name, who deals in proud wrath. Now, this is God, right? God literally gives a nickname to people who are angry and proud. He calls them proud and haughty. That's their name. They deal in selfish, proud anger or wrath. Only by pride comes contention. If there is tension in your home, if there's tension in your church, if there's tension in your life, folks, one or two people at least are being proud. This is Bible. You can blame it on whatever you want to blame it on, but I'm telling you, if there's contention, there's pride. An angry man stirs up strife. A furious man abounds in transgression. You know, one of the toughest things I have to do at times with some boys that I have to counsel who come from incredibly angry homes, I, mom and dad, do everything I can to encourage kids to have a good, strong friendship with their moms and dads. Okay? Because like 5 years from now, those of you who have teens, they'll probably be gone. But what do I do when I got a kid that comes to me and his dad is an angry dad? And my Bible says, make no friendship with an angry man, lest you learn his ways and become just like him. You say, what do you do? I don't know. It's tough. It's tough. Because often you look at your child and it's simply nothing more than a small mirror. There's nurture, there's nature, but oh, what we teach our kids that we don't even know we're teaching them. It's kind of sad. You know if you're an angry person or not. And that, by the way, you don't have to be a screamer, okay? There's two kinds of angry people. There's pouters and shouters. Which one are you? You might hold it all in, but oh, I tell you what, the tension, mom, that permeates the home, because you don't have to say a word. All I can say is if you're angry, and especially wives, if you argue with every single little decision your husband makes, my Bible says you're proud. And God resists the pride. He only gives grace to the humble. Number five, being devastated or defensive by criticism, being unteachable. You see, a wise son hears his father's instruction, but a scorner hears not rebuke. Hear counsel and receive instruction, that thou mayest be wise in the latter end. Does it tear you up when anybody has to confront you about anything? If someone actually is willing to put their relationship and their friendship and peace on the line to tell you something needs to change in life, why is it that we become prickly? It's easy to hug a teddy bear, but it's really hard to hug a porcupine. And some of us live like porcupines. Some of you teens, you don't want to hear anything from mom and dad. And you let them know it. Sometimes you don't say anything. Just go to your room, slam the door. That's all it takes. Your pastor studies, works hard to take this book and open it up in a way that we can understand it, because this book is breathed out by God and it teaches us what is right, what is wrong, how to make the wrong right, and how to keep it right. And we go home and do nothing different, because we don't want to be told we're wrong. You know your own heart. And all I can say is if you are very, very defensive, and you have to prove why what you think or what you do is right and everybody else is wrong. And again, I'm trying to be kind here, but if that's your life, you are proud. And if you've been living like that, you probably wonder, why is it when I pray, my prayers are never answered and I haven't grown? The same problem I've struggled with for the past 15 years is still here. It's because you're trying to do the Christian life in your own strength. And none of us can do that. None of us. God knows our frame. He remembers we're dust. And he pities us. I'm telling you, folks, we fight these battles without the power of God. We're not going to win. We're not going to do it. Number six. Believing that secret sins are no big deal. This is huge. And I put the question up here, what was the sin of Sodom? And immediately I know what we probably think regarding the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. But do you realize that their choice in their immorality was not their root problem? It was only the fruit of what was going on in their hearts. You want to know what the true problem is? Look what Ezekiel says here. Behold, this was the iniquity, the sin of thy sister Sodom. Pride, fullness of bread, and abundance of idleness. That's what was in her. And in her daughters, near she strengthened the hand of the poor and needy. They were haughty, committed abomination before me. Therefore, I did take them away as I saw good. Pride, fullness of bread, abundance of idleness. They were selfish. They had everything they wanted, and they had nothing to do. That is a recipe for disaster. And our poor teens are growing up eating from that recipe every day of their lives. When I was a kid, you had to work all the time. You had to clean the stalls and bring in the hay, and you went to bed tired. Once in a while, maybe on Saturday afternoon, you'd have time to go play. And now, kids, it's not your fault, but what do? Like empty out the dishwasher and take the trash out? Is that it? And a lot of it, Mom and Dad, is our fault because we want to do everything for them. And so we have these homes that we have people sitting around who are selfish. They have everything they want, three or four of every item, every phone and iPad, and nothing to do. So much free time. Then let's watch TV. Let's go on Facebook and find out what people are doing. And then we wonder why we're in the mess we are. Time management is one of the it's failure in time management is one of the biggest problems we face in our kids' lives. It really is. For your kids, help them to set a goal of what they'll become when they're really, really old, like 30 or 32, okay? And get behind them and help them reach that goal. The reason kids don't smile is they have nothing to live for and they need a goal. You press towards that mark of pleasing God, obviously, and pleasing Him with the giftedness that God gave me. I illustrate it this way. A girl came up to me with her sister. She's from Pennsylvania. She just turned 16. And her sister, who was the talkative one, said to the other, her older sister, go ahead, ask Grant. What? I can't ask. You ask him now or I'll ask him. I said, okay, ask me. And she simply said this, do you think it's stupid for me to go to college and major in camping? I said, why you ask questions? I love camping. I want to spend the rest of my life helping people through camping. I love it. Do you think it's stupid? I said, yes. She almost started to cry. I said, it is. I can teach you everything you need to know about camping in one summer working with me. But if you want to work at a camp, you go to college and learn to be an executive secretary, administrative assistant, or major in culinary arts. And I can get you a job real quickly. What? I said, yeah. You mean like cooking? Yeah. Many camps are looking for good cooks. I love to cook. I said, well, I want to introduce you to Cassie. And I did. And she got to talk to her. I saw her then a couple weeks later. She is so excited and pumped. She's 16. She's going to go to college and major in culinary arts. And she's going to do everything she can to learn and work in the summers and so she can become a Cassie. Mm-hmm. What goal do your kids have? To reach the next level in Halo? Duh. Come on. Set a goal. And then do something to help them eat up their time. And Pastor, I'll probably go a little long here. I'm sorry. This is a rabbit trail. I'm sorry. I normally don't do this. Are you so long preaching? Sweet. The second thing is, please keep them busy. You know, sports is great. Physically, you get outside. So have them play on a soccer team. Have them meet some unsaved kids, okay? So that they can have some kind of redemptive relationships with others. It is a good thing. How many of you sometime in your life took piano lessons? Let me see your hands real high. Whoa, a lot. Put your hands down. How many of you still play the piano today? Man, both of you. Okay, thank you. Teach them piano lessons. Teach them to play guitar. If you know how to play soccer and how to play guitar, you're like the king on any mission trip, okay? You really, really are. Teach them to play piano or guitar, even clarinet, okay? Anybody play clarinet here? You know the difference between a clarinet and a lawnmower? You can tune a lawnmower. What am I saying? Don't waste your teenage years, okay? I have a whole message entitled The Peter Pan Syndrome. Peter Pan, I want to be a boy and I want to chase ticking crocodiles and be a pirate and I want to play my whole life. I don't want to grow up. And Jesus, at the age of 12, increased in wisdom and stature and favor of God and man. He didn't waste his teenage years. He prepared to be a man to die for us. Yeah. But that means, Mom and Dad, we have to grab a hold of the time management and the goals for our kids. Okay, one more. Neglecting to ask forgiveness. Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar and remember that thy brother hath aught against thee, leave your gift before the altar. Go first, go thy way. Be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift. Folks, the reason we are anemic in our walk with God is because we play pretend with our worship with God. Yeah, I know you're here, which is wonderful. And you come and you give and you sing and you come to worship. And yet God says, if you have aught against anyone, don't worship me. So I got a question for you. Is there anyone on this earth you refuse to forgive? Anyone? I assume in a group this size, there's some here in their second or third marriage. I assume in a group this size, there's some of you that have a wretched background like myself that was just surrounded by some kind of abuse. Within the last month, I sit in my office with little girls who are 15, 16, 17 who have been sexually abused by parents and friends. And I'm there to help encourage their hearts. And sometimes you're saying, Lord, please help me. How do you deal with this? But God says, if you have an ought, if you have anything against anyone in your family, in your church, in your work, don't worship. Don't sing. You say, Rand, what do? Learn to forgive God's way. What is that? Be kind one to another. This is the end of Ephesians 4. Tenderhearted, forgiving one another, even as God, for Christ's sake, hath forgiven you. So you forgive each other and forgive others the same way that God forgave you. Can you do that? You say, I don't know. I was raised in a home where I literally remember putting the pillow over my head, holding it real tight so I didn't hear Mom scream while Dad beat her. I thought every kid in the world grew up this way. I never, ever heard the words, I love you, ever, okay? So then finally, Mom left us, obviously, and then I was raised by my grandparents, and my granddad was an alcoholic, and we were buds. But when he came home drunk, I don't know if you know much about drunks, but there's happy drunks and mad drunks, and he was a mad drunk. It's terrible, terrible. So I grew up with this foolish teaching that you know. Forgive and say it. Then I'll live in sin my entire life. I'm sorry. I can't forget. I'm here with these little girls. And they're to forget the abuse that they experience. I'm telling you, they can't. So when we trusted Christ, did God forget our sins? No! The song says maybe that he did. But the Bible doesn't. Thy word is preserved in heaven, O Lord. This book will be forever and forever in heaven. And it will list David's adultery and Peter's denial for all to see forever. You say can't because God forgets. No, he doesn't. And I can see in some of your eyes right now, I don't know if I agree with you. If you're to forgive others the same way God forgives you, help me out. Can God forget? Let's talk a little theology here. Is he omniscient? Yes or no? So that means an omniscient God knows everything about everything. Or as my 6-year-old grandson said, Papa, did you know that God is bigger than everything and smaller than anything? So, excuse me, C.S. Lewis, what did you just say? How? God is bigger than everything because he created it. But he's smaller than anything because he can be everywhere. Whoa. God is omniscient. How can anyone who knows everything forget anything? Okay, here's one. Is God immutable, unchanging? Yes or no? You can trust an unchanging God. We change our minds over and over and over, but not God. He is not fickle. He doesn't change that way. He's immutable in his love. He never loves you more or loves you less. He's immutable in his wisdom. He never becomes more wise or less wise. He's immutable in his knowledge. He never increases knowledge or decreases knowledge. Therefore, God cannot forget. You say, what did he do? I have separated your sin as far as the east is from the west, and I will bring it to my remembrance no more. He didn't forget. He chooses never, ever, ever to bring it up to us again. There is no condemnation of them that are in Christ Jesus, Romans 8:1. You say, God can do that. Yes, he can, because he doesn't forget. But he chooses not to bring it up to them again. You see, forgiveness is not forgetting. Forgiveness is a promise. I can do that. I can do that. You say, I don't feel like forgiving. If they come to me first, forgiveness is not a feeling. It's not. Do you ever ask God, don't raise your hand. Have you ever prayed and asked God to forgive you for something like 1,000 times? Do you need to? If you confess your sin, confess, homologeo, to speak the same, if you agree with me about your sin, what will God do? He is fair. He is faithful and just to what? Yes. The 5th time you ask him or the 10th time? The first time. You say, but Rand, I can't forgive myself. Well, duh, you can't. You're not God. How do you deal with this? You pray, God, forgive me for my attitude. I am so sorry. I should never have said that to my wife. I've asked her to forgive me. I want you to forgive me. What do you do when you're still overwhelmed with that foolishness? When you come back to God the second time, you don't ask for forgiveness again. You thank him for having forgiven you 999 times. I'm telling you, folks, it works. Lord, oh, I know I asked you to forgive me. I know you forgave me, but I feel like such a jerk. Can you just, like, with your spirit, remind me of your word that I'm swift to hear, slow to speak, and really slow to wrath next time? Can you help me do that? Do you see the difference? I ask you, is there anyone on this earth you refuse to forgive? You say, but Rand, you don't know what they did. How do you take someone that has seriously, violently, or immorally hurt you? I've shared this with literally hundreds of teens. It's one tiny little word. It's the word pity. You learn to pity those who have sinned against you. When you pity somebody, you feel sorry for them. I teach the kids, if that person that sinned against you really knew God and loved God and lived for God, they would have never, ever, ever done that. And what I did, because of the difficulty growing up in the home I did, I was already in my 20s. I took a piece of paper and put a line down the middle, put Dad. I put love, hate. I filled up the hate, turned it over. I did. When I came back, love, what do I love about my dad? And I'm not being mean. We just had no relationship at all. Okay, he's a hard worker, and he was. He was a janitor in a bank, and he really kept it clean. And he loves to go bowling. You know what I did once a day for the next year? I cut that paper in half. I threw the bad stuff away. And I personally did this. Every day I said, Lord, Dad's getting old. Give him strength to work hard. And give him a chance to go bowling this week. Did my dad change? Yeah, he's still alive. He's like 93. He's like made out of beef jerky or something, you know? Did I change? A whole bunch. Folks, seriously, I just talked to him yesterday. Just a little bit. If he could have gone to a good church like this, and he could have hung out and hiked up to Humpback Mountain, Camel? That one. I'm telling you, if he could have hung out with guys like you that love the Lord, he might have even gone to a Christian college, and he was smart and a hard worker, and he could even have been a pastor like your pastor. He could have done that. He chose not to, but he could have. And I'm going to look at my dad like what he could have been if he was right with God. And therefore, I just pity him that he missed out on so much cool stuff of life. Do you know what I simply did? I did the same thing that God did for Rand. Because God not only forgave me, but he credited to me, my account, the righteousness of Christ. There's no fear in love because this love casts out all fear because God looks at me like he looks at Jesus. Whoa! And you learn to pity people. Because they wouldn't have acted that way against you if they knew Jesus. You can't be mad at somebody you pity. Yeah. So as we close, next slide. If God resists the proud and he only gives grace to the humble, how do we deal with this? Can I be one? One verse. Here we go. To this man will I look, even to him that is poor or humble, of a contrite spirit and trembles at my word. Now this is God. He said, I'm looking down into northern Vermont. Yeah, about 20 minutes from Canada, St. Albans. Ooh, there's a church down there. I'm looking for somebody who is humble, who have already been broken from self, and literally trembles at the thought of disobeying my word. Look at the next slide. He who is humble, I must be God-dependent at all times and remind myself of my need to depend on God every single morning. True God-dependence is a picture of humility. He who is contrite, the word contrite means to pulverize, to crush in the dust. I must crush my selfish attitudes and be broken to the point of denying self and consistently putting God and others first place in my life. He who trembles at my word. I must recognize that God's word has the final say, and I should tremble at even the thought of disobeying it. You know, most of my life is teens, but last Sunday I was in Maine preaching. An elderly woman, about 94, came up to me at the end of the service. Can I talk to you? I thought, okay. But all the people were in line. I figured I wouldn't be able to talk to any of them. And she was dressed real nice and humped over. She says, I'm old. I'm losing my mind. My kids put me in assisted living. Then she started weeping. And my son took everything. Took everything I ever had. And even the stuff he didn't want, he just gave it away. And I will never forgive him. And I'm taking him out of my will. And then she looked up at me. Until this morning. She said, God so convicted me about not obeying him and refusing to forgive. So I forgave my son. I'm going to call him this afternoon. I won't take him out of my will. Thank you for being here. From 15 to 95, folks, you can only live the Christian life by the empowerment of the grace of God. Please, don't be selfish and proud, because God only gives his grace to the humble. Let's bow our heads in prayer.